Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 131st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Stephen Heliker, Christopher Weil, and Clinton Cornwell, all three of who I met at the live show. I am Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Edlow. Today, we're talking to Bill Kiley. He's got a new feature coming out called Age of Summer. It's a beautiful slice of life story about a young boy who joins the junior lifeguards and kind of comes of age and falls in love with the ocean and also a beguiling young woman.
I saw a YouTube review of the movie, and the guy said it's like Kings of Summer meets Baywatch, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, really thoughtful conversation with Bill. Bill's been through the trenches. He started in advertising and did a ton of action sports, snowboarding, surfing, kind of lifestyle videos.
He directed a ton of stuff for Vans, Off the Wall Tour and everything. And he also produced a bunch of movies. And he owns the company Window Seat that I used to work for.
So if you want to learn what it takes to combine the passions of action sports and producing and career directing into your first feature, Bill kind of nailed it.
Well, awesome. Well, before we dive in with Bill, I want to give a quick disclaimer. I've been incredibly sick for the past 9 days. My voice, I sound like I'm a duck to myself. But I don't know what you all will think. But I do want to apologize for my very strange, uncomfortable voice.
I think it's funny that I sounded so much worse in previous episodes. I felt like I was dying.
Oh, I'll have to disagree. I think you sound great at all times.
Well, great. Okay. I'll take it. Well, before we hop into our conversation with Bill, it's kind of been a while, Oren. We had the live show. We've been recording a ton of like super long interviews. So we've been skipping my very favorite segment. Oren, tell me, what have you been working on lately?
Well, I've been just pitching a lot lately. I worked on my friend's true crime show for Snapchat, which was really fun. It was a vertical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shooting some spots at Walt Disney World, and I'm going to go scout next week. And I had to like change my entire schedule because I got this other amazing offer, and I changed my flights. I told the production they didn't have to worry about flying me anymore. And then I ended up last minute not like the talent in this other job I got decided they wanted to use their friend to direct. So I lost that job after I'd like worked my entire life around it. And now I have a one-way ticket to Orlando and no way to get back.
Are you going to go to Disney World for real? Are you going to do anything?
I hope so. I don't know. It's crazy. So I live in LA. I'm going to fly to Orlando to scout this place. I get in Sunday night and they scheduled the scout for 6 a.m. on Monday, which is 3 a.m. our time, which means I have to wake up at like 2 a.m. our time, which is usually the time I go to sleep. So I told them I'm going to be like totally brain dead at the scout and like a zombie. So sure, I might be on a ride and not even realize it, but probably just walking around will be like a turbulent enough experience for
me. Maybe take a segue. It's interesting because I think that, you know, when you travel for work, I always joke I've been to Atlanta a few times and I've only been to the soundstage, my hotel, and the airport. Like I went to a pancake place and that was really nice. And I've been there multiple times. But so Disney World is like the funniest place to fly there multiple times and not do any of the touristy things, because literally all there is to do is touristy things.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting question. I flew there once for the Florida Film Festival, which I highly recommend. It's in Maitland, Florida, which is right outside of Orlando. And on the flight, it was like me and a bunch of kids. And I was like, I couldn't figure out why for a while until like the, you know, flight attendant was like, hey, who here's going to Disney World? And everyone's like, what? Like screaming. It's like, uh-oh. It's going to be a long flight.
Did you know I kind of love Disneyland?
I don't know if I knew that. Maybe I knew. Everyone likes Disneyland.
It's well, like, yeah, but I have an annual pass is what I'm telling you.
Right now you have an annual pass? Yeah. No, you don't.
Yeah, you want to see?
Then you would know it's called the passport.
Annual pass. AP, so they send you a bumper sticker, and that's not a joke.
Wait, you have an annual pass?
Yeah, bro.
Why have you never gone to Disneyland since I've known you and you have an annual pass?
I'm a grown man who goes to Disneyland, so I don't say it every time I go because that would be weirder.
Wait, so when you tell me you're busy and you can't do something like upload an episode for our listeners, it's because you're at Disneyland?
No, that's when I'm working.
Matthew Enlow, your real name is Matthew? Oh my God.
He's looking at my annual pass, yeah.
Learning all sorts of things about you.
So I like going to Disneyland much more than I like watching Disney movies.
Wait, how much does that cost?
It's a couple hundred bucks, yeah.
By a couple, you mean two? Like a few hundred dollars.
This is the Southern California pass, so most of the year is blocked out. It's actually really convenient because like my wife doesn't have a regular job either, so we can kind of set our own schedules. The big pass is $1,000.
Yeah.
So I think this one, I think, is $250. You just have to go twice and it pays for itself.
Right.
And so the real advantage, the reason I like Disney, the way I learned to like Disneyland is... when friends would come down, they'd want to go. And back when I was in college, annual pass was $99. And so rather than buy a pass every time you had friends come down, I'd just like get the pass and then go meet them for the afternoon and not feel stressed out about how you have to go on every single ride or like whatever it
is. Do the park.
Yeah. There's been many, many times where I've gone to Disneyland and not gone on a single ride. And those are my most favorite times.
Wow. Well, I don't know if you know this, but I was also a previous annual pass holder for many years.
I didn't know
all
that.
Through high school. I would go there after school.
Yeah, see, so that's the thing. I know this is not about filmmaking. Apologies, everyone. But this is the culture of Disneyland is the thing that's interesting and fun to me beyond the actual movies or even rides that are affiliated. I think there's something interesting about teen culture being so specific and preserved, and Southern California culture and all that stuff is kind of mixed into this weird multimedia art project. And then also you can pretend to be in Star Wars for 10 minutes. It's pretty great.
No, it's awesome. I did see Coco though yesterday. Have you seen that movie?
Oh yeah, sure. It's great.
Everyone's like, oh, you're going to cry at the end. And I was like so worried it would be for a sad reason, but it was like kind of for a heartwarming reason.
The skin on the grandma character is so,
so good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like wispy and it feels soft.
Yeah, reminds me of a real chicken.
Anyway.
Well, cool. So what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, so we haven't talked about my stuff in a while. So I am on a new Facebook Watch show for a company called Attention, ATTN, which is like Fox or Now This. It's one of those Facebook primarily video news and media sites where, you know, you'll see a lot of explainer videos and things like that. Facebook had a show with them, started a show with them. I came in to replace the old showrunner, basically, who left. So it's been a real adventure of like kind of making the show my own, kind of getting handed everything midstream. You know, we were on episode 8 when I started out of 17. It's been a full sprint. It's been pretty nonstop. So, Oren, you were joking about not having time to upload episodes, but that literally, I've made that mistake once or twice.
Basically, yeah, at the live show, everyone's like, so what's going on? It's Thursday and there's no episode up.
Did people say that to you?
Yeah, someone was like, I usually listen to your show on my way to work and I couldn't today.
Yeah, sorry. Apologies.
But that's cool that people are used to the regular releases of the show. So how many episodes do you have left?
We have 9 left.
Yeah. Okay. For you listeners at home, I feel like I've totally lost Matt over the last month because he's been so busy on this show.
Yeah. Well, and I was in Kentucky before that. So I went straight from Kentucky into the show. And then I was in a wedding. And so weddings kind of take... So I basically didn't have any weekends for a decent amount of time. So this is the first week where I feel like we're back. I'm into a groove now where like we've hired out a writer's room and my graphics team. And, you know, there's a lot of different moving parts. I kind of am bouncing between the suits and post and production and writers all day, kind of in a little cycle like that. So, but it's been great. And we're kind of, I'm getting to up the production values in ways that are exciting and fun. And yeah, I feel like the show is getting better and better, which is nice.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to check it out. ATTN.
Yeah, it's called Undivided Attention is the name of the show. You can check it out on Facebook Watch. We just had an episode launch.
Oh, cool.
The interesting thing is there's been a little bit of a crossfade between the old regime and what I'm trying to do. So there's a little bit of an adjustment period where the last couple episodes, I didn't have any hand in writing really, and or sometimes even shooting all of the pieces. And this first episode that just aired is one where I directed it soup to nuts. So I started with the script and kind of reshaped it a little bit and then, you know, kind of added my own flair to it. So I'm kind of proud of it.
And are you suggesting it's the best one?
I can suggest wholeheartedly that it is my favorite. I think it may be, yeah, you know. No disrespect to the previous regime, but it's more my taste. I would expect it to be, right?
Right. Cool. It's yeah. More autobiographical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about me. Yeah, they're all about me.
Nice. Well, cool. Well, before we get into talking to Bill, just want to remind everyone that we have a Patreon. The URL is patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place where you can give a couple bucks a month to help support the podcast, help us put on live shows like we just did last yeah. week, which yeah. was a wild success.
Yeah, basically our patrons bought everybody the beer that we served for free. So patrons, you get to brag to everybody.
Yeah, and you help us pay our editors, Jay and Chris, and just helps us keep the show going. So check it out, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We appreciate everyone.
Yeah, let's hop into our conversation with Bill.
Okay, Bill Kiley in the house.
Make some noise.
Or Bill yeah. Keeley. On Film Week, Larry Mantle called you Bill Keeley.
Wait, holy man, that's awesome. The Larry Mantle?
Yes, the guy who had a sandwich
up
named
next,
after him.
Bill Keeley with his film.
He's a little soft. Wow, that's so incredible. For non-LA natives, Larry Mantle is like kind of like the local NPR affiliate host. And he, on Fridays, does Film Week. I think I endorsed Once Upon a Time. They do an Oscar roundup where they get a ton of LA critics to all talk about the Oscar contenders. So Larry Mantle is a real delight, Los Angeles treasure. And when I had an office job, we would refer to it as Larry Mantle late. If you got an after 11, I think is when his time slot starts. So,
if you heard
Larry Mantle on the way to the office, you were real, real late.
Yeah. No, when I saw that your movie Age of Summer was on Film Week, I was like, wow, that's like the Sundance of LA.
It genuinely is like a really cool, special thing. So yeah, congrats, man.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, but he did mispronounce your name.
I'm used to that. Yeah.
K-I-E-L-Y, Keeley.
Bill, tell us about your movie.
The title is Age of Summer. And it's a coming-of-age story about a boy's first summer on the beach.
It's a lot of surfing. It's very kind of, it's a period piece.
It is.
It's kind of like got that kind of Kodachrome, primary colors, beachy Southern California feel, right?
And did it take place in 1986 or 1983? I saw there's a big controversy on the internet.
Yeah, LA Times bit into me on that one. Originally, it was 1983. And then when we started putting the soundtrack together, some of the songs were from 1986. And Dan Wilcox insisted that I make it 1986.
Is that the editor?
The music supervisor.
Oh, music supervisor.
He also is at NPR. Dan's awesome, but I did not go back and change the mouse type on the newspaper that shows up later that says 1983.
I know a good VFX guy who could take care of that for you.
You know, that's a thing. Such a bummer. But anyway, a little, you know, details that someday someone will laugh about.
It's so dumb because the LA Times is like, how hard is it to write the right date on the newspaper? If it takes place in 1986, why does it say 1983 on the newspaper? I was like, that is a really dumb thing to like call you out on.
Wait, who was the critic? Do you remember?
I'm not sure of his name. It's
not Justin Chang, is it?
No, but he reviewed my movie.
Oh, really?
He called the score saccharine. I was just telling Bill earlier.
Well, he's also a Film Week regular, so that's why I'd be excited.
I do like him, though.
Is that how it sounds like you're getting a ton of great press. Is that through personal connections? Is that through just like an aggressive PR campaign? How did you kind of get the word out? Because, I mean, I'm teasing, but Film Week is, you know, a big NPR show. There's, you know, this market is huge. And then obviously LA Times reviews are, you know, lifetime achievements. You know?
Right. And it used to be that if you had a movie in the theaters, you'd get an automatic review from LA Times, but they canceled that, stopped doing that like a few years ago. By the way, the reviewer was Michael Rechtschaffen. And his...
he's not on Film Week as far as I remember.
And what he wrote is... Do you mind if I read this out loud?
Go
Bill?
For
Sorry,
it.
It's just so dumb. A greater attention to technical details would have been preferable. Despite establishing that 1986 setting, later in the film, there's a close-up of a just-published newspaper with a clearly visible 1983 dateline. While memory can play fast and loose with time and place, it's nothing a dab of whiteout couldn't have easily fixed. That's how the review ends.
I just want to take critics who nitpick things like that and just watch them make one movie, just one day's worth of shooting. Genuinely, I feel like they would never say something so annoying ever again.
There's one thing about it that I liked. It means you watched the movie really closely.
Sure, that's true.
So, yeah.
You know, it was like almost like he's nodding to me that he watched it. I couldn't believe that that's the way they ended it.
And for full disclosure, I did do the VFX on this movie. Oh. There weren't that many of them. But if Bill would have said, like, hey, can you change this date? I would have been like, no one will ever notice this in a million years.
It's such a funny thing because I figured if I didn't, you know, I figured the music community, the way Dan painted it was if I didn't change it, then the music community would say that some of these songs are later than 83.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
Well, you know, it's silly. It's a bummer that that's what ended up being in the newspaper. But live and learn. The answer to your question is I have a PR company and they came through the distribution company. And
like you hired a PR company.
We did. Yeah. And the initial word that came from LA Times was they weren't going to review the film because they lost a lot of reporters and, you know, newspaper reporting is not what it used to be as far as their bandwidth. And then they came back with the news they were going to review it. And I think that caused a couple dominoes to fall.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point. Getting a big nationally recognized publication like that to pay attention to your movie must mean that, you know, you're bona fide in a certain sense, right? Like other publications know that it's worth taking a look at as well.
I like the way you're talking about this. I mean, it's all really recent. It was all in the last week. So I'm still, you know, kind of trying to catch up.
Sure.
In 3 years of doing this podcast, I think this might be our first time having a guest on whose movie literally came out like 4 days ago or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Normally we're like right beforehand. So like this is an interesting kind of
you're
time
getting
in the life cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. You're reading the reviews. You're seeing, you're like on Rotten Tomatoes. You're in the press. You're in social media. It's like you're in the thick of it. You just premiered on Thursday night and it's like, you know, when it's way different than when you put like a big video on YouTube, but you're just glued to your computer, just like Googling and reading and your heart is like racing and every word someone says, like literally some kid, 8-year-old kid writes a comment and is like, that looks not that good.
And they have no idea that the filmmaker is actually going to read it. And then we're reading all of them. Is there a specific site or... is there like a place that you kind of find yourself gravitating to that your curiosity is kind of like you find yourself revisiting and refreshing that?
Yeah, YouTube with the trailer for sure.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's where there's been the most interaction with real people. Mm-hmm. And we sat on this project for quite a bit. and not any longer than any other feature, but I was real curious to see how people would receive it. Mm-hmm. Those same comments will probably come through the different VOD platforms, but mm-hmm. initially when we put the trailer out, it was fun to see the reaction.
So walk us through we'll kind of go front to back, basically. Walk us through the life cycle of the distribution of the film. So, like, did you have a festival premiere, or did you go directly into theatrical release?
We went directly into theatrical. I'd hoped that this movie would get into a top-tier festival. It didn't. I kind of understand why it didn't.
Mm-hmm. And why would you say that is?
It's not an issue film. Mm-hmm. It's there's nothing political or gender or
sure.
race. And so it's not really challenging in a mm-hmm. lot of ways.
It's not noisy, as they like to say sometimes, maybe.
I like that. And, you know, you hear about they have 9,000 films to watch. And so I kind of understood why it didn't. Didn't make, you know, it frustrated me as a filmmaker. Sure. And we had done a film, The Bachelors, mm-hmm. That came out last year. And we went with Freestyle Distribution again, the company that did that one.
Mm-hmm. And when you say we, you were a producer on that film.
I was. So do you say I was or I am? Those things exist forever.
I mean, yeah. And that was a movie with J.K. Simmons, but you didn't direct it.
No, I didn't.
It's a project that came to your company and you decided to, you liked it.
Yeah, co-production.
Which I don't know if this is a good time to segue into that. Maybe we'll talk about that at the end. I want to talk about like what projects you like what gets you excited about.
Let's circle back to that. That's great. Okay. So basically you leveraged the relationships that you'd had from all of the experience making these other movies as a producer to say, okay, like I'm going to work with these people that we have a great track record with. They'll just release it directly then.
Yeah. There's no easy answer right now with film distribution. Sure. We wanted transparency. We wanted to be able to really understand the process and the numbers and feel good about the film, you know, 6 months, a year from now. Mm-hmm. And Freestyle's good about that. There are other companies we could have gone with where we just kind of have to let go of our baby and it goes off in this other world and we kind of, you know, have our fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. So with Freestyle, we have a relationship. Kind of know where it's going to go. And
there's like literally a call every week, which is like, hey, what, you know, how many views did the trailer get? Like, what are we doing on social media? What are we doing on PR?
Yeah, like, how can we boost this? Like, what, yeah, interesting. That's great.
They were aggressive. We wanted to release the movie this summer. And the other companies I was talking to were like, no, we'll release it in 2019. And I wanted to be finished with it and get on to the next project.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. And then remind me, what is the release schedule like? Are you doing a theatrical run? Is it?
Yeah, we did a day and date. Great. So we're in the theater right now. And at the end of this week, we'll be out of it. There's 10 cities, 10 mm-hmm. markets mm-hmm. For a week. And then we're on in the same day. We're on iTunes and Hulu and Amazon and DirecTV.
So listeners could watch it right now if they wanted to.
They could jump on it right now.
So everybody Bill pause, go watch the movie and then come back.
Well, so Bill and I have had a lot of debates about this. And I mean, he's kind of been like a one-man battering ram against like every traditional movie release person, like the PR people, the social people, the distributors. Bill's theory is that his movie is a coming-of-age movie. It's about a 15-year-old kid. How old is
We don't say the age, you know, teenager. He's about, let's see,
about 15.
He's
a teenager that just moved to Marina Del Rey, Hermosa Beach.
Yeah. It's about a boy who moves with his family from the Midwest to the beach, and his mind's kind of blown by the ocean, and the beauty of it all. And it's basically his first summer on the beach, and he gets into the junior lifeguards, which mm-hmm. is a co-ed lifeguard training program.
Which you did as a kid too.
I did.
Did you have your mind blown by the ocean at 15 or so?
I fell in love with it. This movie for me was about falling in love with the ocean. Mm-hmm. To go deeper, I'm really concerned with the state of the ocean right now. Mm-hmm. And rather than make a documentary about plastics and stuff like that, I'm into feature filmmaking and wanted to make a movie about how I fell in love with the ocean. And if more people could see the beauty that I see in the ocean, if we could capture the spirit of that, maybe some of them would get more excited about it and take care of it.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, that's awesome. And I think the reviews across the board kind of acknowledge that, like, mm-hmm. that this is like kind of makes the ocean like a beautiful and this like kind of big character. And it's just,
yeah,
like,
in the way, say, in the same way that like New York or Los Angeles are characters in movies, the ocean.
Yeah, it's a really good point. As a filmmaker, I feel like, yeah, locations can become characters too, right? And the ocean he notices girls in the ocean, falls mm-hmm. in love with both of them equally. And I think there's a language that goes along with the ocean that a lot of people don't understand. And mm-hmm. I try to tune into that a little bit. There's rhythms and stuff that if you don't live on the coast, you don't really get. There's a lot of water cinematography in the movie where it's slowed down and you really can take a look at the way the water's moving and stuff. And if you're into that, which some people are, and they're responding to it, it speaks to you.
Yeah. And Bill is a bona fide surfer. He's buddies with, like, you know, Kelly Slater and all those guys.
I've spent the 2000s filming surfing in for Vans Shoe Company.
Oh, right on. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I'm a lifelong Vans wearer. I'm slip-ons today. Yeah.
And I use Vans to kidnap people.
Yeah.
Making the first feature, I wanted to take advantage of some of my strengths and I like being on the beach and I understand water cinematography and I understand how to shoot in the mm-hmm. sand and yeah. stuff that other people do not want to do. Mm-hmm. So I figured if we did that, maybe we'd get a little advantage.
So because this movie is kind of a coming of age story about a young guy, the main actor, Percy Hines White, is on that show, The Gifted, that X-Men show on Fox. And there's a girl on it, Brianna Salaz. How do you say her last name?
Salaz.
She was on The Voice, on Team Gwen. There's like kind of a very kind of like youthful angle through the casting, through mm-hmm. the vibrant colors and stuff. And like definitely.
I love the colors are so great. But like just a lifeguard uniform and blue water. Like that's right. just
and
so
the
primal.
Brown sand. Yeah. Kind of like beige sand. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that combination really, you know, I think Bill felt like appeals to young people. And so your theory, sorry, I'm just speaking out of turn here, but your theory is that a young person will see a trailer, want to know, oh, this movie looks cool. How can I watch it now? And if they can't watch it now, they will forget about it in 5 minutes.
I 1000% agree with that.
Yeah, the game's changed. I think if with this day and date thing, you know, the internet paves over itself every night, you know? And so it's fantastic to be able to communicate with my audience or with our audiences so easily through social media, but the traditional model of like stoking the fire a month before the movie comes out really doesn't work for a small independent movie. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of, you know, pushing back on the PR and pushing back on social media teams and saying, look, if there's no product to buy right now, let's wait until the last minute to promote this movie. Cause we don't have a huge amount of money or anything, you know? And so it's really fresh. And so they can literally go and click through and decide to purchase the movie. It's real easy now to just make the transaction happen. But that like anticipation thing that's, you know, mm-hmm. traditionally the way they market movies, I don't think it works for a movie of this size. There's too much good stuff out there.
Right, right. Well, so I guess the counterpoint and something that we've also talked a lot about is like if someone sees a trailer for a movie, if I see a trailer for a movie, I want to Google it, see what Rotten Tomatoes says, what, you know, look at IMDb, see what actors are in it. Like I want to see the presence that this movie has. And if I Google a movie and nothing comes up, then does that make me want to see the movie less? Like, I feel like it's less of a real movie, right? Would you
sure.
agree?
Yeah.
That you need to create a history of the movie before it comes out so that you're attacking people on all sides and, you know, that whole idea of like multiple impressions and hopefully you see this trailer like 10 times or this ad 10 times before you go decide to buy the movie.
I think the learning for me was, and it was something my sister Whitney was aggressive about with me and I did not take enough advantage of it was, that when you're making a movie, do lots of social media mm-hmm. and then continue it through the post process and continue it through the Gobi Desert phase of movie making where you're trying to get it finished so that you really have a lot of stuff to cherry pick from. And so you've built up a good audience the whole time. Don't wait until right. the release to try to grab thousands of eyeballs that would have liked your content. Go after them the whole time and you'll be in a better place when it's time to release the movie.
Did you ever do the AMA? The Reddit AMA?
I haven't, but I still look at all the things we talked about as valid for the next month and a half. And the way the mm-hmm. deal we made is we're in a premium window on iTunes and these different places. And it's not about the first week. It's about really trying to stretch that the right. period where you're still on the stove as long as possible.
Right. I guess there is like a little bit of trying to spike that algorithm early on, right? Like those pre-orders and those, you know, that initial weekend clutch window kind of keeps that tail, that long tail, quote unquote, to be a little more fruitful. But yeah, I agree for sure.
Netflix does a great job of like, they'll email you like, hey, we think this show you're going to like is going to come out mm-hmm. at the end of the month. And then the day it comes out, they email you, hey, tonight, watch this show.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think that two-prong approach is just like really important. And I do personally think the trailer has to be the first thing that comes out before the movie, because it's literally the best example of what your movie is going to be like.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a chicken and an egg thing, right? Because I think that, you know, in building an audience, the spiking a trailer and spiking the algorithm for a trailer on, say, YouTube or wherever you end up posting it, that is also going to be a big first step, right? So like if you've managed to like kind of dovetail all of the different audiences from all of your talent and all of that, the different wells that you can draw from early on, get them all in one place and ready for the trailer, that's kind of the first big step. But your point, Bill, is like, if you don't have any content, then when you get those eyeballs, you know, especially if there's an ad spent behind it, but even if it's just your talent's only going to post about your movie so many times, right? There's just a very fine balance that you have to hit, you know?
Well, something we talked about is like making custom things for each actor. Like, let's get a cool clip or make a meme for the main actor and have him post that on his Instagram. And even like Peter Stormare, who's in the movie, has a really good part, but you know, it's relatively mm-hmm. short, like giving him something because people know him, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. It's really fascinating. And I'm curious to see how it all plays out. I don't know if anyone's like keeping track of all the statistics. Obviously the PR company keeps track of all the PR, and the social people probably like make up some numbers about how everything's performing.
They're really excited about their numbers. I'm really excited for this film to find its audience. And that's mm-hmm. what excites me about social media now, is that the primary, you know, sweet spot for this film would be the coastal regions of the mm-hmm. country. And they're reachable with these hashtags. It takes a little while, but you know, the social media company is excited about the number of impressions they're getting. And I'm trying to figure out if they're the right, I don't know if they're the right people. The feedback that I'm getting doesn't really tell me if they're the right people. But yeah, the challenge for me is keeping it alive through this, at least for a month, keeping it really warm, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that's gotten the trailer a lot of views is there's this like beautiful imagery of like kind of good looking people in bathing suits, right? It's not in any way like pandering or, I mean, it's very authentic yeah. to the time, but it is something like when I think of a movie idea, I always try to think of like what the trailer is going to be. And then like thinking about why that trailer would draw people, especially visually, is like something that's like good to keep in mind when you're pitching someone a movie mm-hmm. and the trailer kind of sucks, or like the most interesting thing about your movie is a secret that's revealed halfway through the movie that can't be in the trailer. You know, to me, that's like not a good pitch.
Yeah, it was humorous to see the way different people picked the cover image for the trailer. And, you know, they...
Sure. Right, because most of the postings of the trailer on YouTube are not ones that came from you. They came from people that picked up the trailer.
Yeah, only one of them came from us, and then it just... People went off with it, which is cool, which is what you want to happen. But it was interesting to see the different way they interpreted the image that they represented the trailer with. Hmm.
So let's rewind just for a second to like the origin of this movie. You've been, you know, you just mentioned that you had filmed stuff for Vans back in the day, did a ton of surfing stuff, skate stuff, commercials, stuff for the military. You've had this company, you've produced films, you've been in the business for a long time, always kind of, I guess, from the way I see you, as like primarily like as a director with a creative vision, but also like helping shepherd other projects. Why did it take until now for you to do your first feature?
When I was in college, I wanted to do film and I didn't know how to do it because I wasn't living in Hollywood or didn't have any family members here. So I got into advertising. I put an advertising portfolio together, got my first job at a place called GSD&M, an advertising agency in Austin, Texas. And they said they would let me do TV commercials, which is what I wanted to do. So I thought that was like mm-hmm. a really good way to get to do music videos and mm-hmm. then maybe movies.
Right, Fincher and, style.
Yeah, I mean, that was the Fincher era, you know, Spike mm-hmm. Jones, Fincher.
Gondry.
Yeah, all those dudes. Yeah, that was the model, right?
It was Matt actually interned?
For Propaganda?
Roman Coppola?
The Directors Bureau.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. But my manager, Larry Shapiro, got us started Propaganda.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was like bumming around there and AD'd for them for a long time.
Yeah, I knew the dudes at Propaganda and was going, when I was going to Art Center, I was going to hang out at the Propaganda parties and thought that was a pretty cool scene.
Art Center, big graduates, Michael Bay, right? And who else? There's somebody else like super
there Pixar fun. People that went there?
To Art Center? You're thinking CalArts.
Oh yeah, CalArts, sorry.
There's a couple other like namey, Joseph Kahn maybe?
Yeah.
Seems like an Art Center guy.
Fast and Furious dudes. Art Center was really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, really inspiring place to be. The film program was really hands-on. I went there because you get to like check out a camera and everyone kind of needs it as much as you do. So cool place. But yeah, Propaganda was killing it. And so I thought that would be a way to get to do films maybe someday, or maybe it'd be cool enough just to do that. And then I signed with a company out of school. And the SAG strike happened at the same time. This is around basically 2001. And the place that I was signed, like super cool place, they were like, well, everyone's on strike, so we're not working for a couple months. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? I want to like do something, you know? Like, I can't believe I'm not going to get to do anything. So one of my buddies was graduating from school, and we were like, well, let's start our own production company and do some stuff. And somehow a friend called and he's like, yeah, Vans is trying to salvage a production that's gone wrong. I think you could fix it. And so I got this Vans gig that turned into more work than we could do for like 10 years.
Wow.
And it was really creatively satisfying. The people.
Let's back up just a tiny bit. How did you know the friend who called you, and why did that person call you?
He was a guy that I met at my first job in Austin, mm-hmm. Felipe Bascope.
Okay.
And he called me and said, he's like, yeah, this production, it had a couple $100,000 in it, and it was just off the rails. He's like, I think you could fix it. And he was a creative director at the advertising agency I went to, and that was really cool at the time.
So you had worked with him already, basically?
Yes. Not really directly. We just worked in the same agency. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was more senior than I was, but he and I both were Californians. Mm-hmm. So like we were both back in California. We were both in Austin working at that place, and then we were in California.
And how did he know that you were looking for opportunities?
Oh, I'd made it real obvious to everybody that I wanted to, you know, direct some commercials and be filming stuff. I mean, I had left advertising at the agency to get on the other side to be in the production world, and was trying my hardest to find projects.
But from Felipe's side, he's like, I'm involved in this Vans project. It's a total mess. I know this guy that's like a true Californian. He's into surfing. He's into skating. He's into beach culture. He's into Vans culture. Like, I'll call this guy. He's kind of like up and coming director. Like it makes Felipe look just as good as Bill. Like, it doesn't matter if Bill's busy or not, right? Like, he's going to call you.
It wasn't Felipe's project. So it was like, he just knew about it. It was on his radar. Yeah, I mean, we worked our hardest and hit it out of the park, and made
out of the skate park,
the snowboard park. It was a snowboard thing. Ultimately, yeah, it was awesome, man. I wore Vans as well as a child, and like that brand really was my DNA at that time, and it was really satisfying to be working with people that I. Working with athletes is a lot of fun. And, you know, the transaction between these people, like, as a director is really satisfying. And for a long time after that project, it was going somewhere interesting to capture something really exciting and then get to do the storytelling part of it.
Yeah. I've got a buddy who does a lot of, surf spots, and like, they're not branded content pieces, but they're kind of like long form videos basically that aren't quite surf videos proper, but like
for like a Billabong or something.
Yeah. It's like a giant brand that I'm blanking on now, but yeah, like that lifestyle is really fascinating because like, especially surfing, right? Like, you're traveling all over the world. You're chasing the best waves and the best locales. Did you travel much, like, or was it more Southern California based?
It was all traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was killer. I really, you know, like when you're younger, you want to travel all the time.
Sure. Yeah. Australia, and Thailand, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot of Hawaii, yeah, which I'd grown up going there. So to go there for work felt really good. Did 9 winters living in Hawaii.
Wait, and, so can I guess kind of what happened between that and Age of Summer, your first movie?
Of course.
So you pretty much got swept up in this branded advertising. Yeah, this riptide of filming this thing, and it kind of started defining who you are. So you're doing advertising, and you're doing kind of lifestyle stuff and sports stuff, and all the jobs you were getting, even if it's like for the U.S. military, it's like guys jumping out of a helicopter into the ocean, right? It's like all kind of tied together. And I imagine in those worlds, like narrative fiction storytelling isn't valued as much as like lifestyle,
just great, like catching the best wave basically with the right light,
or capturing people like as they are, they're truthful, like real, sure, people.
Yeah. Documentary work,
yeah,
you know, and being able to really understand where it was going to go next so you could be there to capture it, you know, like to be in the right spot. With those sports, you really have to work with the athletes to be in the right place to capture it, and then figuring out what's compelling about them and their story to make some content that I have a problem with that word, but I just rolled right out.
Everyone does. It's okay.
To tell their story. And
I don't know that everyone does.
No, well, everyone like, doesn't. Everyone, yeah, doesn't. Some
not brand like business people say people, that. Like, yeah, but directors don't like that word.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is that I have like a lot of snooty artsy-fartsy friends who are like a little younger, and they say content without batting an eye.
Yeah. Really?
Predator types.
Yeah, or no, even just like...
Like a USC film school graduate would say, I'm going to direct some content.
Yeah. And I think maybe I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I think it is the most damaging thing to our
industry.
Business and industry.
Have you heard Tom York talk about that?
No.
There's a really interesting podcast with him talking about how downfall of our civilization is
content.
Yeah, yeah, basically, yeah, viewing it as content to, yeah, fill up hard drives for,
yeah,
for
exactly,
computer companies.
It is the shift from as artists admitting that what we are making is a commodity. Yeah. It's not artful. It's not meaningful. It's like just filler. Like how many minutes of content do we have that represents a library that we can sell and commodify? That is it. Yeah. Content is such a fucking problem.
So we won't say that anymore.
but we're all guilty of it now.
Right? Okay, but so you were working in advertising. You started a whole company, Window Seat Pictures.
Yeah, we started this company, Window Seat, based out of that Vans job. And we had a lot of years through the 2000s where we just our calendar was full with work. And we were doing one-hour TV shows for Vans, a bunch of them. This was before the internet took over. And so I enjoyed making these television shows and editing them and making them really compelling. And then everything started to shift towards the idea of web-based content and webcasts for those events and stuff that I was filming. The writing was on the wall that I was going to have to do shorter pieces and do webcasts. And that wasn't why I got into filmmaking. I wanted to make narrative, you know, stuff that I wanted longer form stories, not shorter stuff. And so I kind of just went the opposite way and was like, how am I going to make a movie? And Joe McAleer and I hooked up. He was producing some commercials I was directing, a campaign I was directing, and he had done a handful of movies. And all of a sudden, it was really exciting to be working with a guy that actually had figured out the independent feature world to the point that he'd, you know, had five projects done.
By the way, Joe Mac produced my first feature, The Hammer. Same guy. That's how I met Bill.
That's right. So... Joe was really interesting to me at that point. Cause like, oh man, this guy can help me make a movie. And we figured out some financing opportunities and I started just reading scripts, you know, and
how'd you get those scripts?
Well, at the time we were working with one of the big talent agencies and they were coming through there. And then everybody I knew, I was like, who's got something to read?
And so if I'm like a new filmmaker, can I just call up like CAA and say, hey, send me some scripts? Or how does that...
Well, they've changed the game. Now they've got things that blacklist and different ways to do it. At the time, I was signed with WME and I was asking for everything that I could read so I could figure out what they thought was great. And then they would show me things that I could potentially throw my hat in the ring to be considered for.
So you were signed with them as a producer?
We were through their packaging department, yeah, as a producer. Okay. And we were also, we had a kind of a multi-prong approach with them where we were trying to produce movies. I was actively producing and co-producing movies at the same time I was trying to direct a movie. I thought it would take me 2 years to get one going. It took about five. You know, life works out how it works out. It's fine.
There were a lot of situations where you got a script. You're like, damn, this is like a good script. Let's do it. You know, we know some people that can finance it. Let's go make this movie. Let's attach some talent. And then the screenwriter all of a sudden is like, oh, actually, I want to direct the film. Or there were so many opportunities. Like every time a good script comes around town, everyone wants it, right?
Yeah. As soon as you shine a light on something and validate it by saying, I'll finance it, or I really want to direct it, please, please, please. Then all of a sudden they're like, oh, okay, let's make sure there's no one else that wants to do this. You know, and I went through
that. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, it was like, there was one that I really wanted to do. You know, I'm sat in the room and basically you're pleading with them to let you take a shot at it. And they looked at my commercial reel and they're like, nothing on here makes any sense for this. And I was like, you know, I'm trying to make a break from the old and do something different. And it's going to be challenging. So that took more time than I wanted it to take.
And I think kind of the shocking thing about it is like, even if it's not like the financing that you're looking for, even if it's just like the good script, that even that is hard to get.
Yeah, it's really hard.
Like your first feature ended up being this autobiographical story.
Yeah, I never thought that would happen. That wasn't the plan. The story's been in my head for many, many years, but I did not think that was going to be the way it went down. I worked real hard to light up a couple different ones.
But ultimately, like, I guess it's something we talk about all the time, but you have to prove to someone why you're the one that needs to direct this movie.
Yeah.
And if it's your story, if it's about surfers, if you're casting real surfers, you know, and teaching them to act, if you're doing all this stuff that is based on this giant, you know, years of experience that you have, then it's so easy to pitch yourself. If you're like, hey, I want to direct this movie about like this young girl in Namibia, you know, then people are like, why you?
Yeah. I had locked in, like, I decided I was going through this phase where everything I read, the third act was solved by someone shooting someone else. Like every single screenplay had, like, it was like the movie. I thought it was so good. It's so good.
Right. Hold on one sec. Let me change my third act.
Okay. It was like every single one. I'm like, I really like it. And then all of a sudden the gun gets pulled, the person shoots a person and the story's over. And I really, really had a hard time with that. I was like, I can't really get behind that, which was, you know.
Wait, can you tell us why? It's just too easy?
It's one of my friends was murdered and I saw that go down. So I take the gunplay stuff really seriously, you know, and for, you know, if I'm going to spend years working on a project and it's got to have a real good reason for someone capping somebody at the end. And I like watching stories where that happens all the time, but to be the person in charge of that project and really.
And when it's not earned.
Yeah. It's gotta be really justified. So it wasn't.
Well, and your point of like, oh, there's a difference between gunplay in a movie and it solving the movie, right? Like one person killing another and that's the happy ending.
Yeah.
Is a real decision, you know, for as a storyteller to be okay with that, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite endings of a movie is Gran Torino. And this is a spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. And I know a lot of people hate that movie because the acting is horrible.
The kids finally get off his lawn.
Yeah. You saw it, right?
No.
You haven't seen it?
My friend Carrie made it, though, actually.
Have you seen it, Bill?
Yeah.
You haven't seen it, Matt?
No.
It's Oscar nominated.
Yeah. There's a lot of Oscar nominated movies I haven't seen.
Can I tell you the ending?
Yeah, yeah. It's been 10 years. I think I'm okay.
Okay. So basically, Clint Eastwood has established himself as this guy that is racist and goes and shoots at all these other people, gangs. He's pretty much like the ultimate Trump fan. No offense, Trump fans. But he goes basically wearing this big jacket, like looking like he's packed with all sorts of weapons to go take down this like enemy gang that's bullying the kids that live next door to him. And he gets there and they see him like with his giant jacket packed with weapons. And they just like fire, like pull out their like what semi-automatic rifles or whatever, and just like gun him down. And then the cops show up and, you know, it's revealed he had like no weapons on him. And all those guys go to jail for just like shooting some old man that was walking on their on their front lawn. And so to me, that's like a good ending, you know,
it's a martyr for the scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. But also it's like the not shooting someone is how you win. Right.
Yeah.
And also they established from the beginning that he like hates life. Ever since his wife died, he's been depressed. So like for him dying is actually like
a happy ending.
Yeah. Happy ending.
These were genre movies, genre screenplays in an indie place. So mm-hmm. it was real challenging terrain to navigate, thinking if I make this movie, it's not going to be received in the festival circuit. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure out which way to go. And my moral compass was telling me the whole time, like, you're not into violence. Mm-hmm. So don't let that be the third act. And I still struggle with that. I still read great things where I'm like, oh, that's how it ends, huh?
Yeah, right.
I mean, Wonder Woman was like one of my favorite movies of last year, and the third act is like atrocious, I think.
It's pretty rough.
It's like literally some random guy turns out to be this god, and he's like having a fight with Wonder Woman, and she wins because she's got like more love in her heart or something so dumb, right? But it's so good, like until then. I still like the movie, but
I mean, you're going to spend, 3 years of your life rehashing this thing, and you got to be really into it. So I was trying to do a different project that also focused on the water. Mm-hmm. It needed two actors to trigger the financing, mm-hmm. and that was going slower than it needed to. And then we switched gears.
Can I ask you some numbers because we love talking numbers on the podcast, and feel free to say that you can't say it. But like, let's say you have a movie and you're trying to get an actress like a Shailene Woodley or even like someone like,
I don't know the answer to that one.
Not a Shailene Woodley, but like, I'm trying to think of like a Hailee Steinfeld.
Yeah.
How much money do you offer someone like that to be in your movie?
We have to call Joe.
Yeah, the tricky stuff with that also is that, there are SAG minimums for the different tiers of like how much your movie costs in total, right?
Yeah. Right, right. But the minimum, you're not offering anyone, like you're offering them like $1 million. You're not offering them like $112,000 or whatever the minimum is.
Sure.
Right?
Well, but depending on your tier, right, like SAG ultra low budget is $250 total. So if your budget is over that, right, say you need, say Hailee Steinfeld costs, $50,000, then, and you can't make your movie for $200,000, then not only does it cost you the $50,000 to pay Hailee, and these are just arbitrary numbers, but also like it bumps you up into a bracket where everyone else becomes more expensive as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the crazy thing when you get into the favored nation deals or the different tiers, and all of a sudden your budget goes up a whole nother level. Everybody incrementally goes up. This happens in all the different categories.
Right.
Right. But let's say we have a listener that just their grandpa just died and they just inherited $2 million. And they're like, oh, I can make my movie because I know I only need $500,000 to shoot it. Mm-hmm. What star can I get for that $1.5 million? And then it might turn out not really anyone that matters, right?
Yeah.
Or can you always get someone great for $1.5 million?
Well, there's a difference between great and
like you'd probably get Christopher Walken to do a couple days on it, right?
Sure. Who is great?
Right, right.
Yeah, I think the screenplay should be the thing that attracts the talent rather than the paycheck. But
well, so in your situation, when you were trying to attach two actors to that movie, mm-hmm. you think the screenplay wasn't doing it?
No, that wasn't the issue with that one. We had solved the female lead. And the man, it was actually another water thing, go figure. And the physicality of the male lead was something that had to be, was a real thing. The person really needed to do things in the water. Mm-hmm. And for it to be believable and authentic, it just couldn't be anybody. So some of the people we talked to, fantastic actors, said, I think this is really cool, but I can't do it. They were being honest. So it was a nice conversation to have with them.
Can you be a little more specific in terms of like, is it that you needed them to surf really well or,
this character had to, teach his daughter how to sail a, outrigger canoe. And, there was a bunch of sequences where they're going to be sailing this outrigger canoe from island to island and had to have the physicality that a person that could do that has.
But you, so you couldn't double it or cheat things at all.
I'm not into that.
Yeah.
In the age of GoPro and all these other things, doubling is not an option for me. Obviously, it would be in a big stunt sequence where you could you put someone's life in danger. But for you reference surfing, so to talk about surfing or the sailing or that stuff, I think you got the actors got to do it, which makes it more complicated for me. But the type of movies I want to make, I want to be really intimate with them.
So this is interesting. So you mentioned GoPro. Would you say that, because when you say GoPro, I immediately, and action sports, immediately I'm thinking about like, oh, you're, you know, you're sticking cameras kind of all over the place. There's one on the board. There's, you know, you're kind of planting things different places and it's a little more verite style is what I immediately kind of just start, my mind goes to. Would you say that the influence of all this decade of shooting, lifestyle, verite, documentary, action sports influenced the way that you approached the scene work in your movie?
I think it for sure does, but it's not a conscious thing. I think what happened was is when I was at Art Center, I was – okay, so I come from the sports background where people are doing these crazy things that in the past they doubled people for them, you know. But now that we've – thrown the doors wide open and said, no, look, we can watch these dudes do it up close. We know what it looks like. So we can't go back now and use stunt doubles. And I mean, sure, if you're James Cameron and you're doing motion capture stuff and
or on like that face level, replacing.
Yeah, they did that in Blue Crush to some success, you know, they had male surfers surfing for the girls, but I don't want to do that. There's girl surfers that can surf that well.
Right.
So this stuff was just, you just want to have the option to be right up. And I mean, the close-ups of people's faces is how you can really get into movies, how you really connect with them. And that's what those cameras are allowing us to do, you know? I mean, at the best, it's not, they, in fact, those small cameras take away a lot of the nature stuff. They're so wide angle, you know, a lot of the like stuff in the background goes away. So you just know it's that person doing that thing.
Right. Right. And, did you find that in Age of Summer you were using a lot of GoPro or
no? GoPro was referenced just because it was a game changer.
Uh-huh.
I don't have any affiliation with them or you know, my son has their newest camera and all that, but I think that the story of that Nick Woodman's, like what he did, like he wanted, you know, he had that wrist mounted camera and then to where he's taken it is really amazing. But it really just drove the idea that my casting director, Nancy Foy, when we started casting, we're back talking about Age of Summer, where a couple of the roles, there were surfers and everybody surfs, but then there's people that are really good at surfing that have like, it's a lifetime commitment and or grew up doing it, you know, and you can tell by the way they ride the board, the way they carry the board, the way they paddle the board around. So Nancy Foy, fantastic casting director, she signed on pretty early on this with me and said, introduced me to everyone in LA that said they could surf that was that age. Now, we were starting out, this movie's made up of teenagers, so you're already at a disadvantage because you're dealing with people that haven't done a lot of things, so your pool is smaller that you're drawing from.
Right.
And she's introduced me to people that said they could surf, and some of them were really good actors. And so I took these people out to the beach with a camera guy and said, all right, you surf, I'll surf too, and we'll be filmed. And really quickly, you saw that they couldn't surf because they didn't have that. Like, they didn't catch any waves, first of all. But, like, if anyone says to a surfer, hey, I'll film you for an hour, if you go surf, that person's going to surf their brains out because
they're auditioning. So, of course, they're going to go for it. Yeah.
It was... So the point was with Nancy Foy was that we needed people that could actually surf because we weren't going to double them. Nancy was like, oh, you could just double them. I'm like, no, actually you can't. That period because of the GoPro thing is gone now. There's no going back to body doubling in a movie like this.
So you ended up casting people because of due to their surfing abilities more than their acting abilities?
Well, I wouldn't say more than. I worked real hard to find people that could play the roles that were in the screenplay, that would be the character. It was more like finding the characters in the real world. And then we engaged John Markland, a fantastic acting coach, to work with them before we shot to work out the kinks. And I really like the idea of making a movie with real people mixed in with actors. We're in LA and I still wanted it to feel authentic, and I want to have a spirit, an independent spirit that tries to solve some of those problems. Mm-hmm. You know, the community got really excited about having the community's people in the project. Mm-hmm. And they feel like part of the landscape in a way. Those people do. They really fit in, you know, and it doesn't feel like a bunch of people plunked down in one place. It feels like they're from that zone because they are.
Mm-hmm. And how does this acting coach work? I mean, we've talked about this before. Matt's wife has done some acting coaching, but do you say like, hey, here's a script. This is what I was thinking. Like, go get this actor or actress to get there.
It could. For this, it was more about taking this group of people and having them be together for a little bit and doing just different exercises to get used to accelerate a relationship. So since, you know, if I could have had more things in this movie, one of the things I would have asked for was more time to hang out before we shot. Mm-hmm. So people can actually develop friendships or weirdnesses with each other so that stuff, you know, comes across better.
Did you change the script at all based on who you cast?
Yes. But not as much in the pre-production, more how you edit the film. Basically, you take a look at these people's strengths once you've shot it, and you're like, okay, I need to cut around some of this person's weakness. For me, the characters were, in this movie, there were two characters that had to be very good at surfing because that was what the boy was observing, was wanting to be in the water and wanting to be able to do that. And that was what I, you know, that's this language I was talking about. As a surfer, you look at someone, you can tell that if you're watching someone surf, you say, oh, that guy spent like years in the water the way he's able to handle stuff. Kind of like the way someone would ride a horse, mm-hmm. you know, and they'd be like, have a way with a horse. It's kind of the way that those people are in the water. So these characters had to be able to surf at around the camera and then talk in the water. And so you needed people that could really do it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a process question actually, or a practical one as a person who's shot so much in the water. Cause I did a video for Ellen where we had a bunch of ladies surfing and I was like, do I need to be in the water?
As the director, you mean?
Yeah, I was like, what is the most practical way to communicate with people in real time, right? Because normally, if we're all on land, I just walk over to them, right? But also, I've got a monitor with me and all this stuff. So tell me just, because there's a lot of really beautiful stuff where you guys are doing the thing where you're like, you dip below the water and then kind of like pop up and it's all very fluid and elemental and stuff. So like, how do you communicate with your team? How do you communicate with your actors? Where are you literally in a ocean scene like this? You're in a paddle boat?
No, most of those I was in the water.
Just in the water. Yeah.
You know, those are some of the most fun moments for me is like being in it, you know, in the mm-hmm. thick of it. So
and are you monitoring? How do you?
We had an Arri camera in an inflatable boat. Mm-hmm. And that has a really low freeboard so the camera can get real close to the water. Mm-hmm. And we had discussed different ways of jib arming the camera out, but ultimately that's just too much of a process to set up and tear down and these mm-hmm. things that eat your days. So it was mostly handheld. Mm-hmm. And so we had monitor work from the boat, but then when the camera's in the water housing, a surf, there's, you know, you can go two different ways. You can go like a surf housing or a dive housing or a cinema housing. Mm-hmm. The cinema housing gave us a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Did it fog up?
It didn't get to that, but we had a moisture alarm, uh-huh. which, once you put a camera in a water housing, you're like pretty much set. You got to work with that. Just take it back apart. It takes a long time.
Yeah. It's like a big plexiglass sort of thing. And like pushing any button is like a real complicated thing where it's like it's this piston that kind of all of a sudden you're just like, oh, the utility of this camera has been minimized to one button record, basically.
Well, that's where, I mean, the answer to your question is it's pre-production. We storyboard out the scenes mm-hmm. and said, this is what I want. This mm-hmm. is where I want to be. This is what I want to see.
Even though you don't know what waves are coming, what the weather is going to be like or anything.
Right. But you know, like that storytelling, how I want to, you know, how close I want to be to these actors. Mm-hmm. And so we did a lot of testing with the surf housing, and the fellow that I worked with on this, Darren was the cinematographer and Ryan was the water operator. I've known Ryan for a long time. He's one of the best surf shooters around. And so, you know, I knew what lens was on the camera, and I was with him in the water, basically, you know, shoulder surfing him.
Mm-hmm. So what does shoulder surfing mean?
It's an editorial term for when you drive the editor nuts by sitting on his shoulder.
Oh, gotcha.
But it works in cinematography.
Sure, well. Sure.
So, you know, when
I call it sidecarring. Right? Okay. So you're like just looking over his shoulder the whole time. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. I'm just sitting with him. And
are you on a surfboard? Are you in the boat? Are you in a wetsuit? Are you treading water? What is it?
Treading water.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a little bit of everything. There was times I was sitting on a surfboard, but the most fun stuff was that we intentionally cast the leads were not water people. They didn't surf. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea, that the characters wants to learn to do this. And so most of the time I was with him, and when we would shoot him, I would go underwater, hold my breath, and we would film him, and then I would come
right,
back.
Right, because you have to get out of the shot.
Yeah. So like when we're editing it, it's like it was usable as soon as I was underwater, and then I would pop back up. And that was because of water safety. Uh-huh. It was so I could communicate with him, and I literally was holding his surfboard the way I wanted it to be to the waves as the waves came through, because obviously the ocean's very powerful, and this kid didn't know how to hold himself in place. And that was a lot of fun for me, because I'm looking back at the beach, and there's like 30 people on the beach and people with megaphones. And I'm just like, there's no way I could be there doing what I'm doing now.
Right, right.
And I'm looking at Ryan. I'm like, did we get what we needed? And he's like, we got it. I'm like, okay, one more.
Yeah.
Let's make sure, you know. You know, we intentionally filmed it in front of a lifeguard headquarters, in front of a lifeguard tower.
Mm-hmm. Did you close down the beach?
No, but we shot it right after the summer had ended and everyone had gone back to school. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want an empty beach, but we didn't want a fully, you know, going off beach.
Because it's a period piece. You don't want people with like super modern stuff on.
Correct. So we had it right in front of all the safety, and then we still had to follow these rules where we had to declare that there were water days, and we had to have lifeguards, and we had a jet ski, and we had a boat, and a lot of like, and it was only 4.5 feet deep. So it was like, it was kind of crazy.
So you're standing, like you're not even treading water. Yeah, you're just like,
it was crazy. Cause I wanted to be in the water all the time. Like, no, we can't do that today. Like the condition, it would be like hot and glassy, and like, oh no, you're not scheduled to do water. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get to it.
Well, we should probably wrap things up pretty soon, but I want to ask just like, so today's Wednesday. The movie came out on Friday, 5 days ago. How do you feel? Are you relieved? Are you stressed? Are you depressed? Are you excited? All of them?
Are you stoked? I did surfer hands.
Yeah. I'm totally stoked, bro. I look at it like it's like a big accomplishment to, you know, like a bucket list thing that I keep going back to that, because there's a lot of anxiety around the sales stuff, and I want things to happen that probably won't with certain aspects of that, and wondering where it'll take me and what next leg of the journey is. But as a filmmaker, it's real satisfying to have something out there that's going to be there for a while, and just keep putting that back in the forefront.
Yeah, I think something really valuable about making a movie about a specific world, we talked about this earlier, is that now Age of Summer is like the definitive movie about Hermosa Beach in the 80s, you know, or junior lifeguards. So the more specific your movie can be, I feel like the longer it'll stand the test of time.
Yeah. Bill, let me ask, if you could go back and do it over again, is there anything you would change or want to tell yourself at the top of your first feature?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think it would be good to workshop with the actors more and really try to get more physical. I think one of the challenging aspects of shooting with young people is that they have their guardians with them, and there's a lot of layers to actually get to know the people. Mm-hmm. So I wish we could have done more of the Mark Lind-esque, like working with each other to learn more about each other, to be able to communicate and draw more out and find the boundaries of what's funny and what's, you know, just like figure these people out. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you're jumping right into it on day one and like you're figuring out how to communicate with these people, and they're figuring out how they communicate with each other on screen. And so more time to get to know the people as a group, mm-hmm. doing stuff together that shared experience that you can use when you try to capture that on screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's tough. That's what I hate about commercials. Like so many times I'm meeting the actors like for the first time on the shoot day. I'm like, hey, be my best friend, Harrison Ford. And then a month later, he has no clue who I am.
2 days later, he has no clue.
2 minutes later, he's like, can I have a coffee, please?
Yeah, who's that guy?
I have one final question. So you're as a director that's pitched movies and a producer that's listened to pitches, do you have any final words of advice to people that want to get like their indie film going? You know, what do you look for in a director and their project, and what do you avoid?
I want someone that totally understands the world they're going to take us to, and that you really look at that person as they're talking to you, and you see through all the layers, and you're like, yeah, I really think that dude's authentic and can take us someplace that we haven't been, someplace mm-hmm. unique. I'm inspired by someone with a genuine like zest for life, and if that person takes me there, then I feel like I'm investing my time wisely.
Cool. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Lust for Life with Bill Kiley.
And don't be a poser, I guess.
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah. Why didn't you tell me that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You finally dropped a little bit of surfer lingo for me. I appreciate it.
That's awesome. And so what's next? Do you know what's going on now?
We're doing, we've optioned a couple of books. Tom Wolfe's last book, Back to Blood. We closed a deal right after he passed away with a very interesting process.
Oh, wow.
It's a story about Miami and the different tribes that exist in Miami.
Cool.
We're writing the pilot for that series. The idea of doing a series is very interesting to me.
Like a TV show.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of doing it on spec, and then you would have to pitch it and sell it?
Correct. That's a pretty awesome story. The idea of the series is very, very exciting and very scary at the same time. The idea of making that much.
Sure. Living in that content. World for so long.
Yeah. I didn't say it. You did. Yeah. There's another one called The Chalk Man, which is a novel out of the UK, which is kind of Stranger Things-esque without the sci-fi aspect, a little more horror aspect. Working with the BBC, trying to get that one off the ground. So those are two things the company's doing. And then I have another feature I'd like to make, the one that I was trying to do beforehand. Mm-hmm. But I'm confused about how to really make a feature stick out from all the television show series stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at Netflix, which unfortunately increasingly is the only game in town, you know, they're spending more money and they're really like revamping the way that they do features. And no one is talking about it. No one cares about their features.
It's crazy. Right. They actually have a lot of responsibility as the leader in the space to educate and to help filmmakers, you know, have not like do us any favors or anything, but to keep the feature art form alive.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and it just feels like there's so much on the table. It's interesting to be so revolutionary in serialized storytelling, not serialized content. Serialized storytelling and not focus on features at all. You know, like that was the cornerstone of their business. And like Amazon, I think is doing a better job at it, but also it feels like so much of their catalog is like A24, where it's like, oh yeah, of course these filmmakers are all awesome. We've known that for 20 years, you know?
Yeah. I think
that's my rant.
You know how like you can go, you know, when you look at Instagram too much now, it tells you you're all caught up.
Mm-hmm.
I think like,
yeah,
I think now
it's kind of depressing when it says that.
Yeah, there's nothing sadder.
I think they need to do that with like the series where they're like, okay, you've binged like four shows in a row. No, yeah. You've watched four shows. Now take a break and watch a movie.
Watch a movie.
Then come back to finish out the series.
Yeah.
Because
it's weird how I'll watch like 3 1-hour episodes, but I'm like, an hour and a half movie. Yeah. Ugh. But I will say,
who has the time?
Just from doing this podcast, I'd say, wouldn't you say a majority of our guests who directed TV have directed at least one feature first? By majority, I mean more than 50%.
Yes, certainly. I'm trying to think of one of many directors who've only done serialized content and not Harry Setup.
I mean, Matt Pollack, maybe.
Pollack and Tony.
Oh, yeah, Tony. But I think so many people, like, yeah. Yes, there is a question of the feature marketplace, which is like a whole, you know, topic unto itself. But the usefulness of a feature as a filmmaker, to me, seems still really obvious.
Yeah, there's a trend of like, we talk to a lot of first-time filmmakers or first-time feature filmmakers who are like, yeah, I made this awesome movie, and as a result, I'm making all these cool TV shows as well.
Right, and yeah, if Amazon did a show about surfers in the 80s, like yeah, you'd
you're
be...
the guy who gets the call.
Yeah, you'd be like, hey, why would you not hire me?
So maybe like adapt a Dogtown as a serialized show, right?
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. Bill, you just lit up there a little bit.
I'm
getting him a treatment, Matt, by Monday.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of this other stuff too. I mean, this Tom Wolfe thing is very interesting to me, and it's dynamic, and there's a sailboat in it.
Mm-hmm. Did someone shoot someone in the end?
There is gunplay, but you know, at this point I'm not directing it. I'm producing it, so I'm developing it.
Well, if you're looking for a director, our pal Charles Hood is great and has sailed his whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Wait, for what? For the Tom Wolfe book?
Yeah.
Oh.
I got the water thing out of my system to a certain degree with this one. So I'm ready to like, but I do agree, like for me, if I'm going to be, you know, do so many days in one place, I really want to love where we're filming.
Sure.
And I love being outside. So. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, all grip, no electric. Well, cool. So if we want to find out more about the movie, we can just Google Age of Summer, right?
Yes, you can.
Do you have a website or a hub of any sort that you're trying to direct people to?
Check out ageofsummer.com. Go on iTunes and look up Age of Summer. And watch
pay
the trailer.
To download it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And windowseat.com is the...
Company website could use some work, but yeah, Window Seat's been my company for 15 years.
Bill, do you tweet? Is there any other way people who want to keep track of you? It's okay if you don't.
I think the only thing I really do is Instagram.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to share your Instagram or is it more of a private one?
Oh, it's just my name and maybe it'll be public or maybe when you go there, but yeah.
Bill Keeley?
Yeah. Pictures of my children.
Awesome. Well,
do you know one of our listeners told me to stop posting pictures of my kids on my Instagram.
So business oriented.
It really does make me laugh. It's so funny. He's like a big fan of the show too.
Before we say goodbye, we're going to go into our final segment, which we call Unpaid Endorsement.
Unpaid Endorsements.
So Bill, you reminded me of one of my all-time fave viral videos. Was the Birthday Boys, a sketch group that had a TV show on IFC there for a minute, did a video before they had the show called Pool Jumpers. And it was like Dogtown and Z Boys, like a documentary, but it was about these renegade kids who invented the sport of catching a ball and jumping into a swimming pool. And it like all the needle drops are perfect. It's like a mixture of DSLR and Super 8 footage. And it is so friggin' good. I love it so much. So Pool Jumpers is my unpaid endorsement.
Cool. Well, I have a drone, in case you guys didn't know. I've been flying it without a license for a long time. And I wanted to get licensed. And I was talking to Matt Barber, a previous guest who also has a drone. And he told me that there's this video on YouTube called Free Drone Certification Study Guide by Tony and Chelsea Northrup. Just this hour and a half video, hour and 43 minute video. You watch it, then you take the test and you'll pretty much pass. He pretty much tells you how to pass the test. You might have to watch it a couple times, but I took a bunch of practice tests after I watched it and I passed them all. So check it out because it's really freaking complicated if you try to figure it out on your own. And if you want to pay for a course, it's like $300. So check out this video. It's got like 85% of what you need to know, which is enough to pass the test. And then I want to, for the time being, unendorse the bug assault gun. It's really ruined my marriage. It was this gun that you shoot a fly with salt, that was recommended a little while ago, and I endorse it even before I use it because people loved it so much. Bill,
I still love it.
Bill has two.
We have two. We have one on the sailboat.
Bill loves it, but every time I use it, I blast salt into the air and it gets on something my wife is consuming, whether it's a glass of wine or a plate of food. And she says no way she can eat it anymore. And I was like, who cares if there's a little salt on your food? And she says, well, the salt is like literally bouncing off of a fly onto my food. I have to throw this all away.
Yeah.
And it's been really rough on my relationship. And all these flies I'm shooting are just like flying away right after I shoot them. So
you're giving me that gun?
Bill has recommended. Well, I'm going to try your recommendation of Himalayan salt.
A chunky Himalayan sea salt.
Yeah, right now I'm using like kosher Morton's kosher salt or something.
Is kosher salt, is that bigger than the fine like iodized salt?
I actually might be using the iodized one. There's like the girl with the umbrella.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if maybe Morton's. you should change your grain.
Yeah, you need chunkier salt.
Yeah,
bro.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you just got to make sure your wife's wine isn't underneath that.
Yeah, yeah. Bill and I witnessed
shrapnel,
and it was
impending divorce.
Well, we'll just say Orin is drinking salty wine while we record
this
episode.
Right, and I'm sick, but I'm still drinking that wine so that you won't be upset that we wasted it.
Maybe throw some honey in there as well. That'll help out.
Okay, Bill, what do you got?
I went into the Mollusk Surf Shop here on Sunset today. Those dudes are real cool.
Real cool.
Here in Silver Lake.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that shop, which is based out of New York, I think, and they've got San Francisco and one here and then one in Venice. They do a good job of supporting what surfing's all about.
Yeah. It seems every time you walk in, you're like, oh, maybe I should surf. This is cool.
Yeah. The poster, we had a funny thing happen with the poster. There's a surfboard on the poster that's mine.
The poster of your movie.
Of Age of Summer, yeah. And it's this one, you know, surfboard company out of Hawaii. And I found all these people online were excited and mad that I took the logo off the surfboard. And mm-hmm. I went into Mollusk today and saw they had this Campbell Brothers line of surfboards. And surfing community is opinionated and strong, and they do a lot of beautiful things too. So that shop, Mollusk, is my unpaid endorsement.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Bill.
Yeah, thanks. If you want to ask Bill any more questions, we are happy to forward them to him. If you want to ask us questions, give us your comments, tell us what you think, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're at justshootitpod. On Twitter, I'm at SmiteyPyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Our producer is Madeline Rosewatt, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to right now is by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.